So first of all, I'd like to introduce to you, for those of you who don't know him, Manar Vashwani, who lives in Jordan but is actually a Syrian citizen and who has been a journalist in Jordan for many, many years, who works for, well, according to him, the best newspaper in Jordan. And he's written an excellent paper, I believe, about making peace work. So over to you, Manar.
Thank you very much. The aim of my paper is to address and explain what seems to be a paradox within the Arab attitudes toward peace. According to many public opinion surveys in the Arab world, the majority supports peace with Israel and accept the negotiations as the only way or the accepted way to achieve peace in the Middle East. But when we look at the results of two peace treaties between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Jordan, we see completely different results and conclusions after signing these peace treaties. 30 years now, when we are talking about the Israeli-Egyptian treaty, and 15 years since signing the Jordanian-Israeli peace treaty. We can talk about many indicators, of course, of what we can call the cold peace, which means that peace exists only on governmental level. In other words, that when you are talking about the people in Jordan, the people in Egypt, and on the other side, the people in Israel, we cannot talk about any normal relation between the both sides. Of course, this cold peace on public level, we can now say that another indicators on governmental level, we can see the same indicators of cold peace penetrate the official or the governmental level. Just 2 days ago, for example, Haaretz published a story about the relation between Jordan and Israel. And according to Haaretz, the relation between Israel and Jordan is worse than the relation between Israel and Turkey. While when we are talking about Jordan, we are talking about exceptional case, because Jordan, especially when we are talking about the regime, King Hussein, the late King Hussein, and now King Abdullah II, were eager to start war peace, not only governmental peace. Of course, when we try to explain these indicators, we need to understand the expectations of peace in both countries. I mean Jordan and Egypt. Usually, we concentrate on the conflict about the land or about the borders between Israel and its neighbors. But we should add something very important, and this factor was really very clear in the case of Egypt and in the case of Jordan. It's the economic benefits of peace. And President Anwar Sadat, who signed the peace treaty with Israel, and King Hussein of Jordan, tried hard to convince the public in both countries that peace with Israel will lead automatically to prosperity. Because we suffered a lot in the region because of conflict, because of unstable situation in the region. Now when we take a look about the outcomes after 3 decades in the case of Egypt and 15 years in the case of Jordan, we can say that the economic benefits of the peace treaty between Israel and its two neighbors, almost there is no achievement at all. Of course, in the case of Egypt, there is many explanation for the situation after what happened in Lebanon in 1982 and what happened regarding Jerusalem in 1980. But in the case of Jordan, it was supposed to be completely different, because Jordan signed the peace treaty only after signing Oslo Accord. So people in Palestine were expecting that peace will be comprehensive, will be all over the region. And because of this, because of the lack of any achievements, of course we can say now, people don't think that there's any benefits because of this peace. More important, and we need to talk about this, and I think this is the most important aspect when you are talking about the outcome of peace, that when you are talking about peace, even when you are talking about Anwar Sadat, President Anwar Sadat of Egypt, of King Hussein of Jordan, both of them, when they signed the peace treaty, they were not thinking about just signing peace treaty with Israel. They were thinking about their peace treaty as a first step toward signing or achieving a comprehensive peace in the whole region. So, if after failing in achieving such progress, especially when we are talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it became almost impossible to go ahead and to move the peace from governmental level to more warm or normal peace, because people will never accept to feel that they are dealing with Israel at the expense of the Palestinian rights. And I can tell you, I live in Jordan, I can tell you any step toward Israel on public level, people see it as a kind of avoiding the Palestinian rights and as giving legitimacy to the Israeli occupation. But we should understand something very important, because I have only limited time, and when we are talking about comprehensive peace, we should not think that even if Israel decided to sign peace treaty with every country and to also to find or to accept just solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that will lead to warm peace automatically. Here we should also admit something very important when we are talking about the internal level in the Arab world. When we are talking about regional cooperation, because regional cooperation, according even to the Israelis, mainly now President Shimon Peres, is the only step to create warm peace. But when we should admit that the gap between Israel and the Arab countries prevents any genuine regional cooperation. So, in this case, we have to admit that it's not only Israel that and the occupation of the Palestinian territories, of course the occupation of the Golan Heights, that prevent any progress toward more normal or warm peace. Actually, we should admit that we have our own problems in the Middle East that prevent any cooperation. So when we are talking about how to make peace work, we need to understand it's not only to work on regional level. I mean, not only between Israel and about Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and the Palestinians. It's also about creating the environment within the Arab world. In this case, we need to understand that creating the environment needs reform in the Arab world. We are not talking about only economic reform. We are talking about political reform also. We need to understand in the Arab world, after decades of using the Arab-Israeli conflict as a pretext to prevent any political reform, people expected that after signing the peace treaties, whether unilateral or as a part of a comprehensive peace, we will see more progress regarding the political reform. This actually wasn't the situation, whether in Egypt or in Jordan. What I want to say in brief, when you are talking about warm peace, it's not to wait, especially when you are talking about normalization, it's not just to wait until we sign all the peace treaties, then we can start talking about normalization, or in other words, more, not to be to use sensitive word, to talk about regional cooperation. In my opinion, it's important to make a progress on both levels and in both sides. I mean, to make a progress on political level, which means mainly to deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but at the same time, we need also to achieve some progress regarding normalization in the region. When we are talking about such a progress, on both levels, this is important because when we achieve, from the Arab world, and when we achieve some political progress on political level, mainly when we are talking about the Palestinian conflict, the Palestinian question, this will give me the confidence or the reason to go ahead and to accept more normal relations. And this was the situation actually in Jordan after signing the peace treaty in 1994. because even the Palestinians themselves were very confident that the Gaza-Jericho agreement, which led to the establishment of the Palestinian Authority, will lead to a Palestinian state. So in Jordan, they became more open toward such relations with Israel. And we can say the same about the other countries in the Gulf. And we saw many indicators about political relations or diplomatic relations in case of Qatar, sometimes in United Arab Emirates. But it's not completely diplomatic relations. And also, on the other side, such normalization will give the Israelis an indicator that they are going to be accepted in the region. And in this case, they will be more confident to feel that they are now part of this region and to make more concessions regarding the land as part of security. So we are not talking about separated developments, we are talking about comprehensive peace, and this is what we mean by comprehensive peace, to deal with all the issues and to create the environment within the states, including the Arab world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So that was a sort of high political level, and Manar really is an independent mind, and he has proven that over the past 4 months, not afraid to criticize anyone, including his own government. Now, over to Sagit. Sagit is from Israel, and she's a researcher. She's a very special kind of researcher, because in her research in Israel, she has had the opportunity to interview the leaders, the imprisoned leaders of all militant or terrorist groups in Israeli jails. And as a result of that, whenever something comes up in the news and you're hearing about someone either being released or arrested or causing trouble of one sort or another, Sagit can usually provide you with an anecdote about that person, because she's very likely to have spoken to that person over many, many hours. Now, Sagit came to London and she continued her research, albeit in a sort of slightly different way, and she will tell us about that now.
With your permission, I prefer to stand.
With my permission.
Sure. My research is mainly about non-radicalization and individuals that are not participating in any violent or radical activity. And the question is, why do some people prefer to involve in a violent act while others prefer not to do that? And I will try to compare between both views and paths that individual can choose. This study is a qualitative one. I did interviews with Arab Muslims from three different groups. The first group is non-Palestinian Arabs, Arab Muslims that born in Arab country, not Palestine, moved to the UK for their study or work and not involved with any organization or terrorist act. Group number two is Palestinians, Palestinian movement, Muslims that born in Palestine or Israel came to the UK to study or to work and are not involved in any violent act. And the third group, both of those groups I interview here in London. The third group is violent Palestinians, what people just mentioned, leaders of Hamas, Fatah, and Islamic Jihad, who were involved, interviewed in Israeli prisons. I will try to find the differences between those three groups, especially between the non-violent and the violent group, but as you will see further, sometimes the differences are combined between the Palestinians and the Muslims and violent and non-violent, and you will see. My main findings are, my main findings is, one, the opportunities, meaning the social background and the family status that these people came from, whether it exposed them and allows them to see other possibilities for finding solutions and getting involved. Activism, meaning whether they were keen to be active and to take active role in favor of the conflict or not. Opinion on the use of violence, and feeling toward Israel and Israelis. Opportunities. That the difference were mainly between the non-violence and the violence groups because the two non-violence groups came mainly from very wealthy families that had the opportunities to go abroad and to study, to come here to London or to other places and to see other environments and social place and therefore to be exposed to other solutions. As you can see, Palestinian from group two, he said, even with all I've gone through in my life, I've never turned into violence because I saw other possibilities of action. I was exposed to other solutions. Other people turn to violence because they are so angry and frustrated, but they have never seen other options. They think it's the only way. While the other group, the group of the radical people, most of them came from very different background, very difficult one. Most of the time they told me about a lot of very difficult situations. They didn't see other opportunities or possibilities to use other methods, and they thought that violence is the only way. As you can see from one of the Fatah leaders in the prison, he explained, the situation at home was very hard. My father barely worked. At the age of 16, I left school and went to work because my father got sick. I worked at the garage during the day and in Coca-Cola factory at night. My brother Ali was a shaheed, meaning martyr, that was killed by the IDF. My other brother is a prisoner here with me, and the fourth one doesn't deal with politics. He is sick and needs special treatment in Jordan. Now, probably all of you, like the name Bin Laden pop up in your mind. Yes, there are, and you're probably right, there are many, quite a few terrorists that came from a very wealthy background, and they did have the opportunities. But while I was talking about opportunities, it's only one factor that can influence somebody to decide whether to use violence or not. You have to take into consideration other factors, such as social background, such as family, friends, even personality characters that can influence, or critical events in his life or traumatic events that can influence one's decisions. The second finding is about activism. And here's the difference is between the Muslims and the Palestinians. Because the Muslims around the world, while I was talking to them, they were very interested in the conflict, very interested in knowing what's going on and what's happened. But they were not really keen to take an active role and to join organization and to participate in any act towards it. As you can see from one of the Arab interviews that said, I have close family in Gaza and we have good connections with them. During the war, we talked to them and heard about the terrible situation they were in, but never thought of doing something active against it. While the other, both Palestinians, they were very, very passionate in taking an active role against it and trying to find a solution, whether it's non-violent or violent one, but they were very keen to do that. And as you can see, one of the Hamas leaders in prison, he said, I do not understand how it is possible that there are people outside that are not active in any organization. How people can suffer in this situation without objecting to the occupation. They are cowards, going through suffering and humiliation and do not object. I think it is not normal. I had to act. I cannot see myself watching my nation suffer, and not do anything about it. They were all very passionate and active solution. The third one is opinion on the use of violence, and here the differences were very wide between the three groups. While the Arabs, they say they have no relevant to any act of violence. They don't agree with it. Muslims is not related to any violence, and they object to admit that they have any relations or anybody that offered them to use violence in order to promote their interests. As you can see, I never came across any opportunity to commit a violent act. I believe that extremist Muslims are not Muslims, and that the Islam does not meet extremity in any way and does not deal with it. That's Muslims. While the Palestinians, that was a little bit different because they could understand why somebody will use violence in order to promote his interest. They can sometimes justify it, but they choose another path. While the radical Palestinians, the ones that I interview in prison, they justify violence. They think that it's the only solution to promote their interest and to get rid of the occupation. And as you can see, one of the Hamas leaders said, "I believe in my actions and support them. I do not call it violence, but liberation. I'm causing damage to the one that caused me damage. I will never hurt somebody that did not hurt me." There's another nice example, Islamic Jihad prisoners that said, "I did not kill them because I do not like them. It is because they occupied my land and destroyed my life. If there was another way, I would have used it. We do not like blood and we do not like to kill and to be in prison. I'm just a person who wants to live." The last findings, which I think it's the important one, and it relates to what Manar just said, is that feeling toward Israel and Israelis. And the difference here was wide between the groups. The two groups I interviewed here in London, it was very hard for me to find interviews. Most of the people didn't want to cooperate in the research and didn't want to talk to me. But the ones that did agree to talk to me at the end, between the Muslims people, I found that they possess a view of openness and, like, we have friends, Israeli friends, we can speak to them, but when we actually sit and discuss, I felt like a very suspicious toward my intentions. They weren't open up enough and there were, like, barriers between us. And it was very, very weird for me to see that. One of the Arabs interviewed explained it to me about the anti-normalization movements that are going on in the Arab world, just like what Manar said. He said that there is a race of movements around the Arab world that promote anti-normalization with Israel. It is a common phenomenon these days, and people are afraid to be blacklisted because they may have connection with Israelis. It is a big problem in the Arab world and a huge hindrance for peace. But it is mostly because of the ongoing occupation and the policy of the Israeli government toward Palestinians and the Arab world. The Palestinians that most of them didn't want to talk to me out of principle and they really didn't want to cooperate with me. But the ones that I did spoke to, when we met and when we started to speak, they were very open and talked freely. We felt like we know each other and we both tried to find a solution, even on a personal level. And they explained to me how they went through a process of hating Israelis and Israel at the beginning. And while trying to find a non-violent solution, they start to dialogue with Israelis. And they met them and they understand that they have their own problems. As you can see, I was a student at Al-Quds University during the Second Intifada, and the IDF carried out lots of operations in refugee camps. It was so emotionally horrifying, and I hated Israel so much. I did not consider them as human beings. That was what made me want a solution so badly. But while I started to look for this, I met Israelis and made Israelis friends, so now I see them as humans again. The third group, the Palestinian prisoners, this is very interesting because they did a total separation between me as an Israeli and me as an Sagit is just a person, and they admit that. They know that because it's like two different things. And you can see from two examples that I bring from Fatah prisoners that said, "I just want to help my nation to get rid of the occupation. I did not kill in order to kill. We saw the pictures of the Israelis' victims and the Palestinians. We want to live. They are the occupiers, not us. The problem is the occupation, not the Israeli people." So I asked them, "But you killed a person, not an occupation." And he said, "Why, he's in my land. He's an occupier. He knows that he hurts me." Another example from Islamic Jihad prisoner. He said, "The only problem I have is with the occupation, not with the Jews. There are two different lines. Maybe you will say it's hard to separate between them, but I'm doing the separation. The first line is me as a person. I am sad and angry inside me for everyone, everything that has happened. Even for the soldiers, I've killed with my bare hands. But on the other hand, as a person who lives under occupation, I'm telling you that every soldier has to die. My problem is not with Sagit because she is a Jew or an Israeli. My problem is with the occupation. It took my life. I separate between the people as people and the people as a symbol of an occupation. You can see the separation. I'm sitting right in front of him, and he's talking in a third person. They are the occupation. Why he's in my land? Sagit is a person. He couldn't say you're the occupation, the occupier. So that's the difference that you can see. To sum up, the main findings is what I came up with is the exposure to the conflict is very important. The Palestinians who were exposed to the conflict more than the other Muslims, they are the ones that want to act, and they are the ones that desperately want a solution. And the tendency that's going on these days of Muslims religious movement that try to wide the conflict to ones of Muslims against Jews conflict, which is a very, very terrible. It's a problematic situation because that way we can never find peace, because only the ones that do care, they are the active ones, as we saw in the research. And on these findings, I'm less optimistic. As Manar says, there is a very big problem with anti-normalization against Israelis in the whole Arab and Muslim world. And I think that if people wouldn't want to talk to each other, then we will never get peace. Thank you very much.